Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first day of fall, the 22nd of September. We have a great guest this hour. Professor Julian Zelizer will be joining us in just one moment. He wrote recently on CNN.com that struggles with health care came as a surprise to some Democrats who felt that after the 2008 election, the era of conservatism had ended. President Bush was ending with historically low approval ratings. Democrats have won control of Congress and the White House, and a president who didn't shy away from liberal causes, such as the need to pass comprehensive health care reform. He also writes that conservatism taps into a basic anti-government ideology that has existed in the nation's political culture since the Revolution. Anti-government sentiment has ranged from opposition to federal taxation to an unwillingness to create strong centralized bureaucracies. The conservative movement has focused on building a strong organizational infrastructure that could outlast any specific president or congressional majority. Professor Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. His new book, From World War II to the War on Terrorism, will be published shortly. His recent commentary, Conservatism is Far From Dead, published this week on CNN.com. He's also working on a history of the Jimmy Carter presidency, a history of the Reagan Revolution, an edited volume about the George W. Bush presidency. He's a regular contributor to CNN, Politico, The Huffington Post, and The Washington Independent, and has published in Newsweek, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The LA Times, with a Boston Globe and American Prospect. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. We'll have many, I'm sure, as we talk about conservatism, and we'll also be looking at healthcare and the debate, which is in full force starting today, as if it hasn't been for the last few months. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Zelizer, always a pleasure to have you on the air. Hello, thank you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. It is amazing the power of the conservatives, and we might even call them, I don't know if you'd agree with this, they're extreme conservatives when it comes to the health care debate and other issues, but they focused really on the health care debate and on the bailout. The voices are very, very strong, aren't they?
Yes, and I do think many Democrats were caught off guard. I do think there was a sense after 2008, both because of very real problems that Republicans and conservatives still face and faced back then, that liberalism was going to be much stronger or much smoother sailing. But what we've seen with the health care debate and with the bailout, which I think is an often neglected part of the equation, is, you know, a revitalization and strengthening of a movement that certainly did not go away.
And who are the leaders of this movement? Are they members of Congress or are they elsewhere in the media, et cetera?
I think there's, you know, I do think there's not a clear cohort of exciting leaders at this point. I think the people who are tapping into conservatism do include media people like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh, who have been at the forefront of stimulating especially the more radical elements in the movement. But members of Congress are, I think, very important as well. You know, from Mitch McConnell to Joe Wilson, I think a lot of legislators from southern areas, from the West, have been, you know, playing to these constituencies that were thought to be gone or so distraught after 2008 that they wouldn't be a political force.
I can remember not that long ago doing talk shows citing polls on how the American public felt about a public option. There was great support for that, and I'm not sure what the numbers are on that today, but you would think that only a tiny minority of the American public would be in favor of such a health care reform at this point in time. It may not be true, but certainly it's been portrayed that way.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think America is full of contradictions, the public and politicians. And, you know, by saying that conservatism is still relatively strong in this country and an important political force, it doesn't mean that liberalism isn't. Or just by saying that Americans don't like government, it doesn't mean that at certain moments they want government. You know, our history is full of these contradictions. And I think the people who make the mistake say that we swing to one side or the other, and the other side is gone. In the 1980s, conservatives made the mistake during the year of Ronald Reagan that liberalism had disappeared. And when Reagan tried to do things like eliminate Social Security, they discovered the administration that many Americans wanted certain forms of government. And I think there can be a comparable mistake now that liberals think because there is support for some kind of health care reform and because this is still a popular president, that means somehow conservatism has disappeared. And it's a back and forth that we see in American politics rather than one side being triumphant over the other.
And what about this ongoing debate between centrist Democrats and liberal Democrats when it comes to health care reform? Centrist Democrats calling for, as you write, big reductions in the scale of the health reform, public support for Democratic health care proposals having fallen. How are they going to work this out?
Well, the centrists have won so far. I think that's pretty clear. I mean, if you focus on where President Obama was during the campaign in terms of a much more expansive argument about health care reform and where we might be ending up with Max Baucus's bill, you can see how Democrats were sobered in the last few months. Items such as the public option have almost disappeared from possible passage. Even the subsidies for working and middle-class families have greatly diminished. And you could see, as Obama courts the centrists and is more distant toward the liberal base of his party, part of that is an internal party debate, but part of that is dealing with the limits of what's possible at this point in time in the United States.
Let's talk what if here for a moment. The president came off this amazing victory. Nobody really put him in the race early on. It was historic for America. What if he had come out very strongly at the beginning of the summer, if not before, saying, this is my signature issue. This is an extremely important issue to me. Here is what I want.
I think it could have been better. I mean, I don't think the opposition would have gone away, and certainly some portions of this opposition are out to get Obama no matter what. But I think one of the things that happened was at the end of July, the Democrats didn't have a piece of legislation yet. The legislation was floating in several committees. President Obama had been reluctant to say, you know, these are the three items that I insist will be on the bill, and he had really deferred totally to the legislative branch. And part of the struggle Democrats had in August was as people were yelling at them in these town hall meetings, and as the media was broadcasting the yellers and the attacks, Democrats were saying, well, we support health care reform, but they couldn't say exactly what that entailed. And I do think there was more damage than the White House wanted in August, and it allowed the debate to shift more toward the right. If President Obama had been a bit stronger earlier and certainly more vocal in articulating why we need health care and what health care should entail, again, without trampling on the legislative branch, I do think Democrats could have been in a little better position going into August.
Well, it isn't as though they didn't have some 50 years to think about it.
That's one of the puzzles. That is a puzzle, I would say, for historians as we look back on the administration when it's over. There does seem to be a sense that the opposition we have seen every time health care was proposed since Harry Truman, that for some reason it wouldn't be quite as strong this time. And I don't know what the answer to that is. There's kind of different arguments floating around about what happened. But certainly there is evidence that they underestimated how vigorous the attacks would be.
You wrote, when conservatives have mobilized this summer in opposition to health care reform, they've been supported by this formidable infrastructure, most of which remains in place. What is that infrastructure?
Well, during the 1970s, you know, one of the things that conservatives did as they built a movement was to argue that we needed to build everything from creating political action committees to support conservative candidates to creating media outlets that would be hospitable to conservative ideas so that we're not dependent on one president or we're not dependent on, you know, Republicans holding control of Congress, that conservative ideas would become ingrained in different parts of American society, and there would be support for those ideas over time. And I think just taking the example of the media, we've seen that quite clearly this summer. The people we've just talked about a few minutes ago, from Glenn Beck to Rush Limbaugh, they depend on certain media outlets. Fox Television, I think, really changed a lot of the tone of political analysis on television. Talk radio is a phenomenon that conservatives have taken advantage of since the 1970s. And those outlets were open, whatever the condition of the Republican Party. Those outlets this summer offered places where these hosts could, you know, rail against the health care debate and tell people to go to Washington for a protest. And then there's kind of less dramatic forms of organization. Again, there's all sorts of political action committees that are raising money to support people like Wilson. After Joe Wilson's outburst at the joint session of Congress, what was amazing was that as the mainstream media was attacking Joe Wilson, he was raising phenomenal amounts of money for his own candidacy, and he became a sort of hero. Right. And that infrastructure is rooted in the 1970s.
Hmm. Don't you, though, in order to be a full partner in this debate, instead of saying we have to start from scratch, I would think most people would say, wait a second, we've got all these people working on a variety of bills, all these amendments, starting from scratch may not be a terrific idea. Would it behoove the Republicans, instead of just saying no to all of this, for them to have an alternative plan?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we've seen that Republicans have focused on a strategy of obstruction and opposition rather than a more creative conservative strategy, meaning from the economic stimulus bill back in February after Obama's inauguration, the main argument of conservatives has been no. No to what Obama wants. And we've seen that play out again in the health care debate. And I do think strategically that can be a mistake. It does cause problems for the White House. It does cause problems for the Democratic majority. It's very good at riling people up, especially people who are on the extremes. But in the long run, to really succeed and to regain a majority, to regain a White House, you need ideas. You need ideas to compel voters to vote for you.
Mm-hmm.
And Reagan was very good at that. I mean, he found ideas like supply-side tax cuts and anti-communism, which, whether you like them or not, were compelling to many voters who were sick of Jimmy Carter and what had happened in the 1970s. Newt Gingrich, like him or not, had a set of ideas in 1994, from a balanced budget amendment to a shift on defense, that were part of how he sold conservatism as something that was positive and not just negative. And I do think now there's a danger that the kind of voices who went to Washington will become the defining voices of conservatism, as opposed to, you know, people who have ideas to offer.
Mm-hmm. Why is it, Professor Zelizer, that health care of all issues, I mean, we all need health care. People get sick, people have problems with insurance companies. It affects everybody, no matter what your political persuasion. Why is it you describe it as historically being one of the most explosive issues that any president can tackle? Why?
I think there's a lot of reasons. I mean, first, we developed our private health care system before we had strong government intervention. I mean, the strongest government intervention comes in 65 with the creation of Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, many Americans were, you know, quite comfortable and familiar with the healthcare system that was privately run. If government had come a lot earlier in American history, we might be more comfortable with a mixed role. But I think there had been a precedent and a certain familiarity with the doctor-patient relationship, with a lack of explicit government intervention in healthcare. Second is, because healthcare is so developed, there are a lot of interests who can lose if healthcare reform passes. The interests range from insurance groups who like the status quo, although they like Baucus's plan, I think, even better, because it will be very beneficial to them, to, you know, most Americans who do have health care and see that by insuring those who don't have insurance, they see a threat to their own system. So you have a lot of investment in the status quo that is threatened. And third, it's symbolically. It's you know, not so much as race, but certainly it's one of the top five issues that conservatives have made a litmus test in many ways of whether you support a lot of government or you don't. And it resonates for those reasons.
Mm-hmm. Would it have been simpler to just, Medicare seems to be a pretty popular program around the country, those who have it really like it. You know, not 9 out of 10 who have it say it's a fabulous program. Would it have been simpler and there would have been less opposition, or would there have been more if the plan had just been, let's expand Medicare?
Well, I think the opposition would always exist. The question is, how do you make the proponent stronger? Some George McGovern, for example, has made the argument we should have just extended Medicare. That would have been an easier way to do this, go beyond, you know, making this a program for the elderly to a broader portion of the population. And I do think there's an argument there. I think a lot of Americans are nervous because they don't understand what health care exchange is or what some of the other portions of the proposal are. Medicare has a clarity, and it's very popular. Ironically, Republicans have now been using supporting Medicare to oppose it. And I do think that could have helped. You know, when they created Medicare, the idea was to create a program within Social Security in 1965 to provide health care. And supporters, including Lyndon Johnson, argued Americans knew what Social Security was. So if we just say we'll also give elderly Americans health care and not just pensions, they would understand what the government was about to do. And it worked. I think that was part of the reason the program passed.
Mm-hmm. What about Ted Kennedy? Would he have been effective in trying to bring sides together? Is his loss deeply felt right now?
I have mixed feelings. I mean, part of me thinks, yes, Kennedy was a big loss early on, that by at first not having him around and then he passes away, he has not been a real voice. And, you know, Kennedy did have the authority to speak both to the public and to Democrats about, you know, what health care should be and why health care was needed in a way I don't think many other legislators have. He was also a great deal maker. I mean, that's one of the things that came out in his obituaries, was he was an ardent liberal and very passionate about liberal causes, but he also knew how to cut a deal. And there is some sense that behind the scenes right now, especially in the next month, as all these bills are still in the air, that someone like Kennedy could have brought the whole thing to a close. The only thing I wonder sometimes is Kennedy was also very polarizing to conservatives, and kind of the counter argument is if he was the person behind this bill, conservatives could go even further in arguing this was a liberal, you know, big government plan. Whereas without having Kennedy as the face behind the legislation, I do think it's a little bit harder to do that.
Mm-hmm. And before we go to phone calls, what do you think is likely to emerge? A bill that's somewhat meaningless? A bill that will insure more people? A little bit of something?
Get a little bit of something. I mean, by all indications, if something passes, and we never think that something will pass for sure in American politics, but if something passes, it will clearly be along the lines of the bill that Senator Baucus has proposed. That falls within the cost that President Obama has talked for, and that doesn't have the public option that seems to be falling off the table for many Democrats. And Baucus has some weight to bring those centrists in line with what the party wants. Some of the reforms many, you know, healthcare experts like, the healthcare exchange where you can look online basically, like Expedia, and be able to pick from plans that all have a certain minimum level of benefits, clearly can create a kind of competitiveness that doesn't exist. Subsidies to buy insurance, which Baucus today said will be higher than his initial proposal, could be very helpful. The real danger is if you pass this, costs continue to rise in the next few years, and Americans are still struggling to pay their health care and now have to buy health care because of a mandate. That could create a backlash against Democrats. So the key is to get the details of the subsidies, I think, to help those people afford health care, to get those right. If not, this could create a modest reform that creates a big backlash.
Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about health care reform. His latest CNN.com commentary was on conservatism and a growing sense among Democrats that the political power of conservatism remains much stronger than some observers believed after Barack Obama's victory in November of 2008. Our phone lines are busy at the moment, but here's the number. Keep trying, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls now for Professor Zelizer. Jim from Milwaukee, hello.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
All right. How are you, Jim?
I'm okay. Being a conservative myself, I'm going to try to at least articulate the conservative position, at least in my opinion. I think it stems really from our founding fathers. Basically, what we fought the revolution on was a strong sense of that centralized government was really overstepping its bounds, when it comes to individual freedoms. That's basically what that war was fought on. Through time, I think obviously that's been deep-rooted in American culture. And, the Constitution was set up specifically with the three branches of government, because of that fear from our founding fathers. Today, to bring it back to the health care debate, I think that Republicans do have some good ideas. Paul Ryan, for example, if you go to his website, has a lot of plans. We have been able to get through several amendments in Congress. Now, most of them have been voted down, and I would argue that it seems like, a lot of Democrats aren't really interested because they have such large majorities in what Republicans have to say. I mean, we hear Nancy Pelosi say all the time that they won the election, they can do what they want. So to be called obstructionist, yes, that's true to a certain extent, but it's largely because we've been unable to get our ideas through. Second question I just wanted to ask the guest was, the reason why I feel that, conservatism may have made a little bit of resurgence in polls throughout time, I think there's been a question that you describe yourself as conservative, liberal, or moderate. And I think moderate has always typically been the largest percentage. But then by and large, from anywhere from 10 to 15%, I think in the mid-30s, people describe themselves as conservative. In a very small percentage, high teens or low 20s will say they're liberal or progressive. And I think that's why Barack Obama is trying to reach out to the centrists and to a certain extent, a very small extent, conservatives, because they make up, most of the population, I think.
All right, Professor?
I think there's various parts to the question. The first is it is true that there is this strain in American politics that goes back to the revolution that is ambivalent, if not fearful, about the role of the central government. And you could see that in our political rhetoric throughout American history. And the structure of our institutions, our government institutions, you can argue, are not set up to favor a lot of government. The barriers are always very clear. The only kind of counterpoint to that is there's also a long tradition of using government in American history. And despite all the rhetoric, what historians of the 19th century have been writing about recently is just how much government there was, from public works projects to develop our roads in the 19th century, to warfare against Native Americans, against the English, to our mail system, which was the most extensive mail system in the world in the period of the early Republic. So there are two kind of competing traditions that I think are always at play. And so I always kind of step back to say, well, America's always conservative or was always pretty liberal, to say it's been a dialogue between the two. And that's kind of the most useful way to think about any given period in American history. On the point of the Republican Party, that is fair, and that's kind of a traditional complaint of the minority. Democrats made the same argument under Bush. It's not that Democrats didn't want to do stuff on the war on terrorism or domestic issues. It was the Republicans wouldn't even let them into the debate. And there is certainly an element of that. I mean, this is an era of strong majority rule, and whoever controls the majority in Congress does not let the minority do much. But if you look at the leadership of the Republican Party, it is not yet offered kind of a very comprehensive idea of if there is this health care crisis in terms of costs, in terms of access, what is the party going to do beyond, one amendment or the other? And while there are certain members who I do think have been pushing forth ideas, I think the leadership has focused primarily on a strategy of obstruction. And Mitch McConnell is not subtle about that. That's primarily what they're focused on at this point, blocking what the administration is trying to push.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. It wasn't that long ago, less than a year, that we had this major election. Barack Obama won a solid victory in this country. What were the American people expecting?
It's hard to know what the American people are expecting. A large number of people didn't vote for Barack Obama, not a majority, but still a significant portion. So they were probably at least hoping that not much would happen in terms of what Democrats wanted. I do think, you know, many Democrats who voted for Obama or had been Hillary supporters were optimistic of a more decisive change in certainly domestic policy, but also foreign policy. That was what Obama's campaign was about from the start. He ran as a candidate of change, that he would tackle ideas that before had been seen as, you know, too politically dangerous. That's how he distinguished himself from Hillary Clinton in the primaries. He was not going to be the overly cautious compromiser. So if we have a problem like health care reform, he wouldn't push to the center. He would offer the ideas that he thought were necessary to solve the crisis. You know, on foreign policy, I think many Democrats thought there'd be a more decisive change in terms of counterterrorism and civil liberties balance and even wars abroad. So I think the expectations were pretty high among Democrats. And I don't think they match the political realities that, frankly, any president would have faced.
So do you think he is being overly cautious?
No, I don't. I mean, I think part of what I was trying to get at the article, he's being very sensitive to the political landscape. I have a quote from him in the CNN article where he rejects the idea that the Reagan Revolution is over. And he says the Reagan Revolution had many arguments that are going to be lasting, including a certain skepticism and ambivalence about the federal government. And I think from the start, the way he picked many, you know, Clintonians like Larry Summers to his economic team, the way in which he shied away from certain arguments he made on the campaign, including on national security, reflects someone who is not just overly cautious, but responding to a political world that he does not see as malleable as he might have when he was a candidate campaigning.
He is starting to be in a bit of a pickle when it comes to Afghanistan, isn't he?
Oh, yes. That's kind of the growing problem for this administration. We now have a report that the situation is worse than expected and that there is a need for a surge of troops. This is a war that is not particularly popular with the American public, and there's questions about exactly what we're going to do if we have a surge of troops and how long we're willing to make a commitment to that. So decision time is coming for the White House and for Democrats. This will require a decision. And, you know, Afghanistan is a notorious place to fight. People lose. Foreign powers lose when they go in there. And right now, it doesn't seem like our situation is very good. He's called this a war of necessity. He's used rhetoric that in certain ways boxes him in. And I think this is a pickle, to say the least. But it's certainly reminiscent of those early years with Vietnam.
Yeah. Tim from Ladysmith.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think Americans tend to have short memories. I think a few years ago when George W. Bush won the election, we heard the same type of things from the public media that, would the Democrats ever win the White House? And, you know, there was kind of this talk that Democrats were kind of dead in the water, and now we hear the same rhetoric about Republicans, which I think your guest points out very well that it's not. I think one of the problems this president is facing, just like George W. Bush tended to face in his last term, is that conservatives just do not trust this president. We believe he was a socialist before he was elected. He ran on socialistic rhetoric. And I think that's the problem with what's going on with the health care debate is the devil's in the details, and he's not really been forthright with the American people. He stated he wants abortion as a centerpiece of his health care reform, and he's told people, no, I don't want that. The truth is, we don't trust him. And
why do you think he's a socialist?
Because of the fact that he has pushed for big government. He's obviously a big government Democrat. He sold himself as a moderate. He's not a moderate. He didn't run on that. You know, it's a kind of like a chicken in every pot, and that's his. That's what he ran on, and that's what I believe he is. He's a socialist.
I don't think it's fair to call Obama a socialist, Professor Zelizar. I know that rhetoric is all over the place right now, but he's not a socialist.
I don't see him as a socialist, and I mean, I have trouble seeing his policies being equated even with the far left. I think, you know, Obama, both in his campaign, but even more, as we're saying, since he's in the White House, has veered toward the center. This health care plan is shy of what Bill Clinton wanted to do in 1993. And Bill Clinton had already moved far away from people like Ted Kennedy, who wanted a single-payer system. The move has been, you know, slowly toward less, not toward more. When we use the term socialism, it means something very specific in American politics, a kind of strong, centralized government control over everything. And this would not leave the health care system, the plans being floated right now, under the control of the government. It just wouldn't do that. Even the public option, which is now, you know, perceived as the most left part of the package, it's not even sane anymore, which we used to say if someone was a Democrat, that the government should provide insurance for everyone. It's not even saying that. The public option is saying the government should compete in the insurance market, with private insurance continuing to be central to the marketplace. So I don't see him as a socialist, and I have trouble with that particular argument. I do think the perception's out there, though, and I think it's a very real indication of the tenor of the debate and the intensity of the feelings, not just about health care, but you're right, about the president himself.
Yeah. And in terms of abortion, it's hardly the centerpiece of his health care reform. But it's interesting when you look at conservatism that the rallying issue is health care reform, and it's not the social issues that used to define a conservative movement not that many years ago.
It's true. I mean, abortion has faded as kind of the key issue, or a key issue at this point. Conservatives, I think, they've used abortion certainly as one of the issues that's been at the top of their platform. But I actually think when conservatives have been in power, they haven't paid as much attention to the issue as we think. Reagan, George W. Bush, and certainly George H.W. Bush did not make that a primary concern. They focused more on kind of economic questions, which would include something like health care and the role of government in domestic life. And certainly right now, you see, it doesn't seem to be as important, at least to mainstream leaders. It was, I think it's more in the kind of town hall movement and the Washington rally. I happened to be in Washington, and there were more signs than you would think about that issue if you were just following the national media. But I think right now, kind of the debate is over the role of government in American life.
Thanks very much for the call. Craig from Madison. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Craig.
I guess the question I have, what frustrates me a bit, and it is, you know, such a topic I came on health, but when I listen to a lot of the shows, it seems like we really talk past each other. When one side will talk about how, you know, everything the government does doesn't work and how Medicare is broken, and then the other side will say, you know, the vast majority of people that, like you were saying before, 90% or so that have Medicare are happy with it. And I think the question that gets hard to get our heads around for most people in the middle is that, yes, most people that have Medicare like it, but at the same time, you know, we keep looking at the numbers and hearing that within the next 4 to 7 years, it's not even sustainable. So then the question is, how do we expand that? I mean, how is that going to work? And I don't know that's been answered in a more direct enough form for people to feel comfortable with it.
Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, I think those are actually the kind of conversations we need. I think the nature of certainly television media right now doesn't make those conversations that are easy to have. People are much more interested in what I've called the yellers and shouters, who make, you know, more extreme statements on both sides about what's at stake. And I think that description of Medicare is very good. Medicare is very popular. The polls are very consistent that it's supported by beneficiaries, yet at the same time there is a concern, a serious concern, that if costs continue to rise, and the president has made this concern central, we won't be able to afford it anymore. And so then you need kind of where is the venue to discuss how do you fix the system without, you know, arguments about just getting rid of it altogether. And I think part of this is the media. It's just not hospitable to people who are going to talk about, you know, an issue like what's the role of how doctors are paid for procedures to, you know, reducing the cost of Medicare in the long term. We'd rather have arguments about, you know, social
socialism over far-right extremism.
Right.
And I just don't think there's a lot of area. But I think that is the conversation we actually need to have.
Yeah. Anything else, Craig?
No, those questions are needed to be answered to get the people that truly, you know, want to do something and have their minds open about it. But I don't know that a lot of people feel that those types of questions have really been addressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. And the president, I know, caught my attention when he gave his health care reform speech, talked about being able to pay for reform by looking at waste and cutting waste in Medicare. And I don't think we've had the conversation. I keep wondering, well, what's he talking about? You know, can it pay for health care reform in a big way?
I think that's very important. And again, there's all these issues that the experts write about in kind of places I don't think most Americans are going to want to read, and it's usually really technical stuff, but about issues from waste to, again, a big issue for many experts is payments of doctors and, you know, using, they get paid per procedure, which is a bad incentive in terms of cost control.
Right.
But those are just, you would really have to look hard to find any discussion of this. And politicians don't talk about it because they won't get any airtime if they do.
Yeah. So why won't they? You have talked about this being the summer when everybody's yelling and screaming rather than debating and legislating, and heavens knows we need the debating and legislating. These are important issues that affect all of us. Why is there all this yelling and screaming everywhere? It's just so disheartening.
It is. Part of it's specific to this moment. I mean, the mobilization against health care relied on a very, really, ironically, 1960s in-your-face kind of politics to get the message out with direct confrontation, with events that were made explicitly to capture the attention of the media.
Sure.
And you saw conservatives drawing on some of the tactics of liberals in the 1960s, and that strategy then created an atmosphere that I think, you know, made debate almost impossible. A second is what I just was talking about. I think the nature of the media, it's clearly become more polarized. Our national media that people watch is set up to be right and left at this point. Whether you watch MSNBC or whether you watch Fox, there is no place to just hear some kind of analysis about the issues in a more, you know, reasoned manner. People want the screamers on television. And so I think it's harder because of the nature of the media as well. And again, look, this is a volatile issue. It often leads to this conversation. When Kennedy and Johnson fought for Medicare, the far right was arguing that it was socialized medicine and that it would lead to the destruction of the country. When Truman did it back in the 1940s, the same thing. So there is an ongoing phenomenon that happens, but I think it's amplified because of the nature of the media and because of the tactics that were chosen this summer.
Thanks for the call, Craig. John from Milwaukee is next. Hi, John.
Well, we had one of the little conservative pit bulls in here over the weekend at Veterans Park for a rally. And the rhetoric that Michelle Malkin used and what she was doing after the her comments bordered on just the creation of inflammatory rhetoric and just citing people's emotions with the worst possible words. She stated that she was criticizing President Barack Obama, his wife Michelle, Attorney General Eric Holder, government czars, Republican sellouts, and union thugs. And this is the type of rhetoric that has been consistent in the far right, certainly in the 20th century. They used to use goons and thugs to kill labor leaders. Now they get on the media and they do the rhetorical assassination. And this is the type of thing that is consistent with their movement. They are very comfortable with this language. They are very adept at it. And this is something that is going to continue in this country. And my biggest thing is that the people were stirred up there to the point where some of them were talking openly about assassinating President Barack Obama. And this is just the type of event that stirs this type of vitriolic hatred, and it has to end.
Professor Zelizer.
I think it's true. I mean, it's been very disturbing to watch certain elements of Obama's opposition, the rhetoric they use, the signs they use. I think most conservatives are not with them. I don't think this defines what most conservatives are about, but there has been a silence from leading conservatives in Congress about these kinds of meetings and these kinds of politicians. There are some in the Republican Party, as just mentioned, who are really stirring up the passions right now. It reminds me when McCarthyism was really at full swing. Many Republicans in Congress didn't like Joe McCarthy, and they didn't like the tactics he was using, but they didn't say anything because it was helping them win support. And there's great, you know, quotes from Republican leaders saying, you know, we don't like what you're doing, but we won't do anything because you're helping undercut Truman's popularity. I do think, you know, there's a push toward a more violent, form of right-wing extremism that has developed in the past month and a half that is dangerous. I do think it's dangerous. And when you add on that the racial overtones of the first African-American president, you're playing with fire. And I do think it's incumbent right now on Republican leaders to say this is not what we're about, and to stop their own candidates and politicians who are playing to these anxieties and fears. There's more than enough to argue about in American politics. And when parties make the decision to take on this kind of form, I think it's really it's not good for the party. It's not good for the country. And we've reached a point, I think, there is a certain level of danger if you're just looking at the signs. That Washington rally had some frightening images. Again, it wasn't everyone, but there were some people there who were, you know, promoting in some times a form of violence that is unacceptable in American politics.
Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, our guest this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, an interesting guest, Andrew Carroll, is a historian. He's the founder of the Legacy Project. His latest project is Here Is Where, and he's traveling to all 50 states to find and spotlight little-known and unmarked historic sites throughout the United States. So you may want to give him suggestions of places that he ought to be looking at in Wisconsin, in Iowa, in Minnesota and Illinois, in the areas in which we broadcast, or certainly beyond. And he's found some fascinating information already. So that's coming up the second hour of our program. Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton, is with us right now. Professor Zelizer, how nervous are Democrats about 2010?
Very nervous. I think most are expecting, as we often have in midterms, usually have losses for the party. And the fear now and the question is how large will those losses be? Basically, the president's invested everything in health care this year. They're hoping he comes out of it with something. But within a couple months, the schedule turns toward midterms. It will be very hard to pass anything. I'd say within 3 or 4 months. That's where most members will be focused on reelection. And if the numbers diminish too much, then it could be a very tough 2 years following that. So, again, I think everyone's expecting losses. They're expecting to retain control of both chambers, but they want to know how slim will those majorities be. We already see that with very slim majorities and a unified opposition, meaning a unified Republican Party, it's hard to pass anything in Congress.
It really is almost a continual election cycle, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, that's not new. Politicians are always thinking of re-election in American history. We have a system set up that way. But in part because of fundraising pressures and in part because of, you know, a scramble to get media attention, I think it happens earlier and earlier in terms of when the running starts. And so right now, really, some people are already campaigning, and that makes it very hard to govern if politicians' minds are on the ballot box.
Mike from Appleton.
Yeah, good morning, Professor. Good morning.
Hi.
My original question was going to be with regards to health care, but I'd like to switch it. And this question of President Obama and I just read a very frightening report from an organization called Stratfor. I don't know if you're familiar with that. And they're talking there about perception and how he's perceived by the Russians and by the Israelis. And basically the perception is that he's weak and ineffective. And I think the big danger here is not so much Afghanistan, but I think Israel may end up doing something and sucking us into a major conflict with regards to Iran. I'd like your thoughts on that.
There is. I mean, there's a story out today. I can't remember where it was, but making the point that domestic problems cause international problems for presidents, meaning foreign leaders, both allies and enemies, watch, you know, how much capital does a president have here in the United States, how strong is he or she eventually politically, and therefore how scared will they be in terms of a provocation. And you know, this has historically been true. The Soviet leaders often were watching very closely at the electoral situation in the United States, including things like midterm elections, to figure out when to do things, when to take certain actions, when will presidents be scared. And I do think if the president can't come out of this health care debate with something, it will be harder for him to be stronger overseas. Again, you can pick which situation you think is most explosive, Middle East, Afghanistan. That's really up to the viewers, up to the listeners. But I think the point that if he comes out of this without anything and looking weak politically going into a midterm where Democrats are going to lose, I do think it will weaken the role of the United States abroad. He has depended in the first year on his enormous popularity abroad and the perception this is a kind of dramatic, decisive election in 2008 to build both support in overseas populations, but also to generate some fear among foreign leaders that if they cross Barack Obama, they are going to anger a lot of people, and that Obama will be able to generate the internal response here in the U.S. that he needs. That could look very different in a few months, and it could have ramifications abroad.
Thanks for the call. Pat from Reedsburg, hi.
Good morning. I originally called after your first caller talked about our early founding fathers having a fear of government. And as a history teacher, I was just thinking, we weren't afraid of government. We were afraid of a monarchy with no representation in Parliament. And it just doesn't make sense to me that we would want to do an insurance plan or a health care plan that would give government subsidies. If I can't afford to pay my whole premium, that the government would subsidize that payment to the same insurance corporations who serve at the pleasure of the people. It's like, why would we want to just perpetuate the whole insurance company bureaucracy?
What do you want, Pat? What are you looking for?
How much representation do I have on a corporate board mm-hmm. that's setting how much they will pay my providers?
Professor?
There is. I mean, the one question, you know, there's this health exchange plan where, again, if you want to participate in a state-run health exchange, again, think something like, you know, Expedia for travel where you can see different plans. Every company would provide a certain level of benefits, but the insurance companies would still be running the show. This does not have any sort of government plan for insurance, and I think it is correct to say that under this system, you won't have fundamental changes in the administration of our healthcare system and some of the problems that people encounter in terms of accessing and influencing the insurance bureaucracies. Some people argue Baucus is doing so well because this is a huge giveaway to health insurance. Now they're going to have millions more customers. What's not to like about this? Without the government playing a strong role. And I do think that's an open question that the next month Democrats have to struggle with. Without that public option, this is really just a measure to create new incentives but leave the insurance system intact.
Thanks, Pat. We go to Dave from Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thank you very much. I agree if they're going to force us to have coverage, they should force competition. I'm rereading Thomas Frank's book, The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule Even When They're Out of Power. And he does a very, very good job of investigating and explaining why, you know, our money is just leaving, it's disappearing. You know, bleed the beast is what Reagan had said. And bleed the beast so that we can get rid of the programs that the Democrats so much cherish. One quote, Thomas Frank had a thing in the Wall Street Journal on the September 1st, and he wrote, one reason government got involved in our health care is that our ancestors understood something that escapes those who brag so loudly at the town hall meetings, that health care is not an individual commodity to be bought and enjoyed like other products, that the health of each of us depends on the health of the rest of us.
We have about 20 seconds, Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, starve the beast. It was actually starve the beast came out of the Reagan years. The idea, you cut taxes, you cut the fiscal strength, the government eventually won't be able to do anything. The other part of conservatism has grown government for different reasons. So what we're left at is in a fiscal straitjacket where it's very hard to find the money for new programs, and that's playing out with health care right now.
Oh, you're good. 20 seconds exactly. Thank you, Professor Zelizer, so much. You're a wonderful guest. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest, Professor Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. If you want to read more about what he thinks about a variety of issues, conservatism he was writing about, he wrote about the president's health reform. He wrote about why it is we're in a season where everybody's yelling at each other. Go to CNN.com. He writes regularly there. Of course, he's also writing on Politico for Newsweek, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and the list goes on. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production. Just want to let you know we're on our way to shortening our fall pledge drive. We have 435 pledges. If we get 700, we'll take a day off, which is good news to you. So go to WPR.org.